What's up, y'all? This is Tony Powell, and you're listening to Powell to the People podcast, episode 18. That's right. There's been 18 of these bad boys. And this one comes at a unique time. It comes following the midterm elections. Now, for those of you who have been listening to me, you know what I am. You know, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool lefty Democratic socialist. And I got to tell you, last week, Tuesday night, I predicted on this podcast in episode 17, I predicted that the Democrats would take the House. And I was kind of iffy on the Senate. And even with these bold predictions I made, I have to admit, I was nervous, man. I usually stay up and I watch the results and everything else, but I must have had some PTSD. I was post-traumatic. I definitely had some PTSD. I could not watch. I turned on the TV, I turned on the CNN, I turned on the MSNBC, and then I saw on MSNBC, I saw James Carville's face, and he was looking all sad and nervous, and he was like, "Wow, there may not be no wave. I was expecting there'd be a wave, and there might not be a wave." And I was like, "Oh boy, oh, here we go again." And then, they were like, election results were coming in, they were coming in slow, and not looking really good at first. And I think part of that is the way these people do it. I know that they released the after polling. They released that there's a document that they give to all of the networks that show the exit polls, and they kind of have an idea of what's going to happen in all these races. So they kind of know going into the night where it's going to shake out, but they can't release it until a certain time. And generally speaking, it seems as though they were just trying to drag this out and have this horse race. And I know, you had to wait for these polls to close. I know that they had, a huge turnout this year in 2018 as part of the, Take America Back tour, backlash from Trump. And so it was going to take a while, but I have to admit, man, I turned it off. I couldn't watch. I didn't want to sit there. Like I did in 2016 and at 3 o'clock in the morning, realize, holy shit, what did we just do? I didn't want to be like Charlton Heston on the beach at the end of Planet of the Apes, screaming at the half buried Statue of Liberty going, "You maniacs, you maniacs, damn you, you blew it all up." I didn't want to be that guy again. I tried not to be that guy again. So I said, let me turn this thing off. I turned it off. And then I woke up the next morning. And it was sort of like Christmas. I was like, wow, the Democrats actually, took this House. And, quiet as this kept, they keep trying to downplay it, trying to say it wasn't a blue wave because we didn't get everything. No, we didn't get everything. But Ted Cruz had to hang on by a percentage point. An incumbent senator in Texas, red as Texas, had to hang on by a percentage point or two. That's pretty damn good. Out in places, that you kind of expected there would be problems. I thought there might be a problem out there in North Dakota. North Dakota, Heidi Heitkamp could not hang on. They did all they could. The Republicans in the state houses did all they could there to make sure that she could not get her vote on. And she was dependent on the Native American population. I think it's so reprehensible that in a state named after the indigenous people there, the Dakota, that they made sure to disenfranchise. They did all they could to disenfranchise the Native Americans that they stole that land from. It's disgusting. And she did a courageous thing by voting no on Kavanaugh. And I guess certain people feel like that was enough to bar her from the door. And Missouri, Claire McCaskill, she lost her seat. And it was an uphill battle. It was going to be an uphill battle anyway. But I think there's some funky shenanigans going on there. And I've been reading on the interwebs where in Missouri that some of the exit polling doesn't jive with the result. In other words, going into the election, and I'm going to talk about Florida in a second, going into the election prior to the last polling prior to says one thing, and then the exit poll is saying one thing, and then all of a sudden you get the results and it's totally different. And people were voting in Missouri for some really, really progressive things. And that brings me again, as I said, to Florida. In Florida, they had some ballot initiatives. One of them was to return the voting rights to former prisoners, former convicts, former felons who had served their time and had served their probation and had, you know, paid their debt to society. They would have their voting rights reinstated. For the longest time, Florida suppressed those people's right to vote, even though they served their time. And that's, it's kind of, it was a unique situation in the country because most states, after you've served your time, served your probation, you get your voting rights restored. Florida would not do that. And why is that a big deal? Well, primarily because the majority of the people, and this goes back to Jim Crow days, the majority of the people that were being incarcerated were black and brown people. So if you want to make sure that you maintain your power base, you lock black and brown people up on the most, you know, specious charges. And then when they get out, you say, hey, man, you can't vote anymore. Oh, OK. So that's what they did in Florida. So the people went to the polls. People went to the polls, black, white, brown, went to the polls and voted to restore these voting rights to these former felons. It's very progressive. So you have a very progressive ballot initiative. People, you know, and I, you know, if you voted, for those of you who voted, you know that sometimes you have to read all the way down that ballot to get down to these ballot initiatives, and you got to read through all of that. And I find it hard to believe that you're sitting in a polling place that you waited online for, you waited, you know, especially in Florida, they, you know, the way they make sure that there's no voting machines available in the hot sun. People make people wait out there in the hot sun, wait for hours on end to cast their ballot. I find it hard to believe that people waited on those lines, sometimes, as I said, in the hot sun or maybe the rain, whatever the weather was, for hours. And then they get in there and they finally get a chance to get to the voting booth, and they're in the booth and they actually take the time to read through all of that stuff, read to the bottom of the ballot and read the ballot initiative and bubble it in or circle it in or punch it out or however they do it down there. And did not vote for the other progressives on the ballot. Didn't vote for the progressive governor. Did not vote for the left-leaning senatorial candidate. So as the results came in, you had a very tight race favoring Rick Scott for the Senate, former governor, and Ron DeSantis for governor of the state. Ron DeSantis, absolute avowed Trump supporter, avowed white supremacist, avowed white nationalist, and he won. There was another thing that struck me when I read the exit polling on Florida. 80% of black women voted for Andrew Gillum. 80%. You say, well, that's a big number, Tom. Yeah, it is. 80%, that's big. It's huge. Which means 20% voted for the white nationalists. Let me say this again. 20% of black women voted for a white nationalist for governor of Florida. Now, this has got to be shocking. I need to meet these 20% of black women because they are the unique group in the entire country, because in the entire country, black women have been the backbone of the Democratic Party. Black women have been the backbone of the Democratic Party. My grandmother marched, went down there to D.C. to hear King speak. Lifelong Democrat, union member, lifelong Democrat. So I know black women. I know black women. You know, my mom, you know, back in the day, devout, hardcore. You know, all my aunties, oh, straight up, hardcore. I find it hard to believe that there's 20% of black women in Florida who voted for a racist. I need to meet them. So right there, something is not right. Something is just wrong here. Something just doesn't feel right. But the election's real close. And when you want to steal an election, you don't want it to be obvious. You want it to be subtle. You want it to be just, oh, wow, gee, what a tough break. What a tough break. Wow. You know, you almost got there, man. Too bad. Better luck next time, you know. Something's not right. I don't know. I mean, please, if you know one of these 20% of black women that voted for a racist, have them, email me, DM me at Comic Tony Powell on Twitter. And I'd like to have them on the show to talk. Cause please, I'm curious. 20%. And as I said, that goes counter to every other state in the union where black women are voting. Because usually black women vote at a 90% clip, better than 90% clip in all 50 states, but Florida. So something's funky there. Something's real wrong there. So to make matters worse, this election, I think, Gillum and DeSantis are separated by fewer than 50,000 votes. They found about 100,000 in Broward County and Palm Beach County. And I think Miami-Dade. And they want to count these votes. These are absentee ballots. These are these provisional ballots where, you know, black people walked in and they were like, no, you can't vote. And so they signed a provisional ballot. And so there's a whole bunch of ballots that have not been counted or counted for. And what happens? The GOP, Scott, claims that it's a Democratic plot by liberals to steal the election from him. And I thought, how crazy is that? You're the governor. You appoint these people. That's your house. That's your house. If you come in my house and find some stuff that I'm supposed to be in charge of, that's not right. That's not on them. That's on me. He is the governor of the state. He's claiming that there's something wrong. That's a liberal plot. Meanwhile, wait for it. Irony of ironies. The person in charge of the elections in Broward County was a Bush appointee. Jeb Bush appointed him. Remember? Jeb Bush, the same guy who made sure that his brother got the state of Florida in 2000. That Jeb Bush. Yeah. He appointed her. Okay. The reason why they panicked is because Broward County, Palm Beach County, Miami-Dade, these are probably left-leaning areas of the state. They're the more populated areas of the state. If you've been to Florida, if you're flying over Florida at night, you can see where the population centers are. You know, they're in the central Florida, Miami, Tampa and Orlando and that area, St. Pete, Orlando. You know, you'd see bright lights and all of that. And if you go down the coast, you're certainly from Palm Beach all the way down to Miami. That's where the lights are if you're flying at night. You know, on the West Coast, you know, maybe somewhere down on the Gulf Coast, you probably have some lights. You know, Tallahassee, Jacksonville, those areas, you're going to have some lights. But that's where the people live. That's where the population centers are. And generally speaking, the more left-leaning population tends to live there, even though Miami has voted Republican for years. I think that the new breed of Miami resident of Cuban descent, the new kids on the block are probably left-leaning, more progressive, more left-leaning. And so they're worried. They're worried. So now Trump is out talking about, well, we got to, you know, just leave the vote the way it was election night. You know, let's stay there. Let's not count the votes. They're actually advocating for that. Rick Scott is actually saying, I want to be senator from your state and I don't want to count all the votes. DeSantis is saying, I want to be governor of the state. I don't want to count all the votes. That's insane. No, who does that? Who does that? I mean, if you go to the store to buy a big ticket item, buy a refrigerator, you know, or a new stove or something, you know, big giant something or other, big Viking refrigerator. And you get a man, you're paying cash. You give him your money. Give him a whole stack of hundreds. Hey, you know, take it out of that. And he says, okay, fine. And now he's counting out your change after you paid for this big item, like the Senate seat or the governor's, you know, house, paid for this big ticket item. And he's counting your change. I don't know anybody that would say after they got a certain amount of money back of their change, a certain amount of their change back would say, nah, you know, I'm good. Stop counting it. That's fine. If you go to the store and they counting your change, they counting up your money, They count up all the money that's due you. You wait till the last penny is counted. That's what you do. That's what you do. That's what I do. If I pay somebody something and they count the money, I wait for the last penny to be counted. I'm getting all of it back. You know why? Because I know how they are. If I go in the store and I don't have enough, they never say, well, don't worry about that last $5-$10 worth. Nah, they want it all. That's how you got to be about these damn votes. Get them all. You got till Thursday. Get every last one of them. Because I think I have the sneaking suspicion the reason why they so damn nervous. The reason why Rick Scott is on the TV. The reason why Trump is screaming up and jumping up and down is because if they mess around and they get this seat in Arizona and then they get this other seat down there in Florida, hold on to this seat in Florida, we might be looking at a 50-50 deal in the Senate, meaning everything will be decided by Mike Pence, which means all the nonsense they put through will have Trump stink all over it. They don't want that heading into 2020. This is it. This is the battle that needs to be fought. So if you're listening, Andrew Gillum, if you're listening, Mr. Nelson, Senator Nelson, hang in there, man. Don't let them cheat you. Get all yours. Get all your money. Don't hold back. Get it all. Be right back. As I was talking about the Senate, I think this story deserves to be mentioned because we have another runoff in a place you wouldn't expect to have a runoff. Down in Mississippi, they're having an actual runoff for the Senate. The incumbent senator, Cindy Hyde-Smith, is running against Mike Espy, a black man from Mississippi, both running to be senator from Mississippi. Mississippi used to be the most populous black state. I think about 40%, it's 40% black now, but it used to, before the migration north, it was probably the most heavily populated black state. And so this senator, this Republican senator, which again, could end up being a flip seat. We don't know what's going to happen in the Senate. As I said, my prediction may not be all that. But this woman had the nerve to say on mic that she would gladly attend a public hanging with somebody else who's running for office. I don't even know this person's name. Doesn't matter. She would gladly attend a public hanging with him, just to show how enthusiastic a supporter of this person she was. A public hanging. She said this as she runs for senator in Mississippi against a black man. I know you're sitting here, maybe you're driving, or you're sitting in your computer, maybe the sound of my voice is soothing and you're taking a nap to me and you thought you heard something, but you're not really sure. Let me repeat this. She's talking about a hanging while she's running against a black man in Mississippi. Now, if you know any history at all, Mississippi was the home of many a lynching of black men. It was the home of the Klan, the civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi, that were tortured and beaten and burned and killed. This is something they did down there. And this woman is old enough to remember this. I actually believe, and I'm going to say it, I don't know if I'm a hole in the wall, but I'm sure she got some family members. I'm sure that watching lynchings is a family tradition and part of her family. I'm going to say that. I don't, she can come after me if she wants to. I'm going to say it, because that she felt that comfortable, that those are the thoughts that she had in her mind, those are the thoughts that came out of her mouth, and she knows she's running against Mike Espy, says all you need to know about her. This is where we are, folks. This is where we are. This is, and I've been railing about this, and I've been talking about it, and podcast after podcast. I'm tired of hearing myself say it, but I got to. I have to. On the same day that we're talking about this, I saw a picture of some school in Wisconsin where the whole, I guess the junior class of 2018 or 2000, whatever they are, all gave the white power Nazi salute for a class photo. Smiling, proud, proud of it. You know, Trump is not responsible for the racism. He's responsible for making the racist come on out. The racism was already there. He didn't create that. I'm not giving him credit for that. He didn't create that. He just gave it a platform. He gave the white nationalists a platform. And I'm going to say something that I know is going to offend a lot of people. It's going to offend some people I know, friends of mine, family members of mine, but I don't care. All Republicans are not racist. You hear what I'm saying? All Republicans are not racist. But all racists vote Republican. That's right. I said it. All racists vote Republican. So, yeah, you know, you can have people out there who say, well, no, I voted for Trump because I believe in his policies and I like what he's trying to do. And, you know, I support him for that. Okay. You know, I asked this question on Twitter. If you vote for somebody that you know is a white nationalist, if you vote for somebody that you know is a racist, a misogynist, a sexist, a hateful human being. And if you willingly vote for that person, if you willingly pull the lever, if you willingly punch the hole, if you willingly circle and blacken in the dot for that person, does that make you a racist? See, because I find it hard to separate the two. You know, if somebody came up to me and asked for my endorsement, you know, if somebody said, hey, man, can I date your sister? And I know this person's a rapist. I'm going to say no. No, you cannot. No, that's not a hard decision to make. No, unless I'm OK with it. If a pedophile asks to watch your child, you probably should say no. Unless you're OK with it. So if a racist is asking for your vote, if a racist is courting your political support, you probably should say no. Unless you're okay with it. And apparently, at least 40% of the country is okay with it. See, I always knew there was at least 20% of hardcore people that would go out there and actually put the sheets on, get the lighter fluid, you know, and burn some crosses. I already knew about those. I knew there was at least 20% of those people out there that would, you know, try to get the spider tattoo on their elbow for killing somebody, you know, wanting to be a skinhead, getting the SS, tattoos on their neck, you know, and just trying to go hard. Those types. I already knew about them. I knew there was at least 20% of those people hanging out in the woods out there in Idaho somewhere at some compound trying to start and prepare for the race war. I knew about that. You knew about those people. When they blew up Oklahoma City, you knew those people were out there. We called them the fringe back then. It was always a fringe group, a fringe extremist group. Well, Trump revealed the other 20%. See, this is what I did not know about America. So like I said, I knew the 20% was out there. One day I'll share a story with you that'll show you how close I came to that 20%. Won't be this episode, but certainly next episode, I'll certainly share this story. I knew that part existed. I came up close and personal with that part. But this other 20%, these are the people that, you know, I was going to work with. These are the people that I was going to school with. These are the people that I said hello to in my building. These are the people I said hello to, you know, at various places of business. These are the people I said hello to in the comedy clubs. I didn't know about that 20%. Because they out now. Well, we've been laughing about at the barbecue Becky's. We've been laughing at the bodega Barbies. We've been laughing at those people. But they're not alone. They represent large swaths of people. You know, today I had somebody on Twitter come at me talking about, they were talking about, now they're angry with the liberals at Fox, which is hilarious. Just the idea of the liberals at Fox is hilarious. But they're angry because, you know, on occasion, Shep Smith tells the truth about what's going on, or Chris Wallace actually calls somebody to the carpet when they say something so outrageous, even he can't swallow that for the check. And, a person actually tweeted at me, Trump, if you really want the truth, you just have to listen, just listen to Trump's tweets and get your information from him directly because he's unfiltered. Now, this person tweets at me, person follows me, tweets at me. And I don't know, I just tweeted back four laughing, crying faces because I could not believe how stupid that was, how silly that was. But again, as I said, these are the people that we know. These are the people we encounter on a regular basis. These are the people we kind of, they're not in the shadows anymore. And I think that's what's really, really the most upsetting thing about the Trump administration is that, eventually we'll get a hold of the regulations. We'll get a hold of the environment, and hopefully the damage done won't be, unsolvable. We'll be able to get a grip back on some of the environmental damage that's being done. And eventually we'll tackle climate change, and eventually we'll secure, our healthcare system. Eventually, we'll raise some of the taxes on the wealthy again and put our economy, house back in order. Eventually, I believe that. But, what's going to be really hard to do, is to look your friends, your former friends, if they're still your friends, and maybe former friends and your neighbors in the face again without suspicion. It's going to be really hard to trust again. And I think that's what's the most painful and the most devastating part of this man's regime. It's not an administration, it's a regime. Is that it's going to be hard to look people in the face again and have legitimate trust for where they're coming from. Because, as I said, 40%, that's a lot of people. People say, well, 40%, 60% is more than 40. That's true. There's more of us than there are of them. But put yourself in a room with 10 people and imagine that four of them are Trump pansies. And of that four, these are people that take four people, 10 people you work with, and four of them voted for Trump and are very proud to be, as they call themselves, deplorables. They take pride in that. They take pride in being MAGAs, Make America Great types. These are the people you work with. These are the people you went and had drinks with. These are the people you used to laugh with. And now you know that they don't think you shit. It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to overcome that. So that's food for thought. Ponder that. I'll be right back. Well, that wraps it up, folks. But before I go, I just saw as I was taping this podcast, I saw that something came across the wires that, I don't know, I guess I'm a little bothered by it. Stan Lee, one of the driving forces behind the Marvel comic book empire. It is an empire. The comic books, the movies, the toys, the products. He died today at 95. And, I'm sitting here and I'm just trying to, it's really, really weird. I don't know Stan Lee. I've never met Stan Lee. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of if you've been listening to the show, if you listen to me, you know that I'm a big comic book nerd. I went to the Comic-Con for the first time in my life this year. And I actually did a podcast, comic book themed co-podcast with the Fireside Crew. We talked about Luke Cage and the Hero of Harlem. And we talked about comic books and movies and comic books as they impact the popular culture. And when you have those conversations, you start to realize the impact of a Stan Lee. History is rife with heroes. you know, the ancient Greeks, you know, told all these great stories about, you know, the heroes and the gods and the actions of the gods and various heroes, whether it be Hercules and the seven labors. And then you have, I guess, out of the Middle East, you have the story of Gilgamesh, you know, this superpowered being. And then, you know, from the Vikings and the Norse gods, you know, stories of Thor and Loki and Odin. And so there's always been mythology, you know, there's always been these heroes of mythology. Even, you know, if you want to go back to you know, the early days of radio, when the Lone Ranger, all of these heroes and these folklore heroes, whether it be Paul Bunyan or John Henry, we've always been fascinated by these characters with enhanced abilities. And so Stan Lee comes along and ushers in, I guess, probably the large universe that is Marvel. I mean, you know, as a kid, I was exposed to the live action shows of Batman on TV and Green Hornet and Kato and the old reruns of the 1950s Superman show. And that was my first exposure to sort of these comic book heroes and characters. And so, you know, to this day, I still think the 1966 Batmobile is cool as hell. I used to love watching that car drive out of that cave. I thought it was neat. Even though the show was just silly and goofy as I look at it now. But back then I was like, wow, you know, so that was my first exposure. And then Saturday morning cartoons kind of started changing the way I viewed the world. I mean, sure, there was the Batman cartoon and the Superman cartoon, but then, Marvel started getting in and on that Saturday morning nonsense, and they had Spider-Man as a cartoon. And Spider-Man is, you know, for those of you that know me, is probably like my favorite superhero. And they also had the Fantastic Four. Hanna-Barbera, you know, licensed the Fantastic Four. Stan Lee has, for the longest time, had been trying to, you know, get his products into mass media and get it out there. So they had the Fantastic Four and Ben Grimm and It's Clobbering Time and all of that. And you just kind of... you kind of grow up with that stuff. And then I guess, you know, as I said, I had a rudimentary, you know, comic book knowledge, but then I met this kid. I think it was in fifth grade. His name was David. I won't say his last name. I won't blow him up his last name. But, this kid, David, was really, really into reading comic books. I mean, just a, you know, I mean, now he fits right in. You know, if you go to these comic book shops, he's that dude. Reading the comic books, he knew everything. He knew about all these characters. And I was, you know, I didn't know a whole lot about these Marvel characters. He was talking about Thor and the Hulk and all of these guys. And then he started talking about their abilities. And, you know, he gave me a comic book or two of his to borrow to read. And I started reading them in the fifth grade. And all of a sudden, again, as I said, you know, my experience with Spider-Man was as a comic book, was a cartoon. But then I started reading the books themselves as a child, and spent a lot of, you know, Saturdays and you know, just days, just, you know, kind of curled up with a comic book, reading them at night, you know, before I went to sleep, you know, under the lights with the flashlight on, just reading the comic books and just being caught up in that world, just getting caught up in this magical world that Stan Lee created. And I think that's what I'm feeling today. I'm feeling like not a piece of my childhood is gone necessarily, because the characters in the industry lives on without him. But I'm feeling sort of a bit of gratitude. And I'll say this to parents, you know, when my son was small, you know, I love comic books and I got him reading them, and he likes them now. He reads them. And I believe my nephews, you know, read comic books, and my cousins read them. If you're a parent and you want your kid to read, get him a Marvel comic book. Get him any comic book and let him read. It'll do a couple of things. One, it'll improve his vocabulary or her vocabulary. It'll certainly spark their imagination. You'll have to visualize a world that's different than the one you live in. As I said, you know, Stan Lee was responsible for. You know, Spider-Man, the Hulk, Fantastic Four, Black Panther. And, you know, if all the black people that went to see the Black Panther, I think, you know, you owe a debt of gratitude to Stan Lee. If you didn't know who he was, you should know, because he brought that character to life in a time when it was not popular. And I think that's one of the things that I appreciated about Marvel versus the DC universe. You know, DC had the Superman and they had the Batman and Wonder Woman and Aquaman, and none of these people had any problems. I mean, you know, Superman's life was cool. He didn't have to deal with a whole lot of nothing. You know, he had a cute girlfriend. Nobody could really hurt him. So he's good. Batman, you know, he's kind of, you know, he had problems. I mean, you know, he lost his parents and he's a bit of a psychopath. But other than that, I mean, you know, still a billionaire. He's comfortable. So no problems. But these Marvel characters, I think Stan Lee decided to have characters that were more than just the two-dimensional drawings on a page. You know, these people actually had problems. You know, Peter Parker was responsible for the death of his adoptive uncle, adoptive parents, which is his Uncle Ben. And, you know, all these great lessons that you learn from these comic books, like with great power comes great responsibility. That's from Spider-Man. With great power comes great responsibility. And you say, well, wow, that's kind of corny. That's kind of cheesy, until you think about it in these terms. The president of the United States, one Donald J. Trump, has great power, but he lacks responsibility. He's irresponsible. And you see the damage that does to a nation. So Stan Lee was right on that. With great power comes great responsibility. The other characters that I think kind of really solidified my comic book love were the X-Men. And why the X-Men? The X-Men were the first characters I could kind of relate to. Peter Parker, I could semi-relate to. I had an Aunt May, you know, but, you know, not the same deal. You know, and he was young and I was young. I got that. Bit of a nerd. I was a bit of a nerd. I got that. But I really could not connect much beyond that. The X-Men, on the other hand, were a little different. The X-Men were a group of mutants. People who had the X gene, a gene that would express itself after puberty, and you discover you have these new abilities, these new powers. And they were, you know, these expressions of power were varied. They, you know, they were just, there was no limit or end to the variations of that expression. Just like people, if you look at a group of people, you put a group of people in a room, and, you know, they're all types of people. Short, tall, you know, light, dark, glasses, no glasses, blonde hair, brown hair, you know, straight hair, curly hair. You can see all types of variations. That's the same thing with the X gene. Millions of variations. But the problem for the X-Men was that they were hated by society, hated by humankind, because they were different. They were special. They were scary. They were worried. Humankind was worried that they would do something to hurt them. And I began to relate to that as a young black man, as a young teenager growing up in New York City. I began to relate to that. I understood it. I got it. I understood it because I could relate to myself. I said, wow, okay. I'm like the X-Men when I come in certain, when I walk in the store and I'm being followed. You know, I'm like the X-Men. When police cruisers, you know, drive slowly as I'm walking to the store right next to me, I'm like the X-Men. I'm feared. I'm hated. I got it. And there were two leaders of the mutants. One was Professor X, and I'm not sure. And I have to, I Google this and I'm not really sure. And there seems to be some sort of, you know, folklore attached to this, and I, you know, maybe somebody will correct me, but someone once suggested that the ideas behind the two characters mirrored the black world, in the sense that Professor X, who believed that mutants and humans should get along, and we should work together to forge a better world, that character was modeled after Martin Luther King, versus the Magneto character, who felt that if humans didn't like mutants, then F them, you know, we'll go out on our own. And if they want to come at us, you know, lay a hand on us, we'll straighten that out too. And that character was sort of modeled after Malcolm X. That's, you know, that's the storyline. But, you know, even the term the X-Men, you know, and black Muslims of the 60s, you know, were, you know, named X. They got rid of their slave name. So I guess the parallels are there. It's either real or it's not. But in my mind, it's real. And that's where I went with it. So I say all this to say that, you know, it's going to be rough to not see Stan Lee do his cameos in these movies. But I do want to say thank you to Stan Lee for opening up my world, making my childhood a lot more fun, for exposing me to this wonderful universe that you created, for providing us with our own heroes and heroines, you know, as we go forward. I mean, you know, we're not the Romans, we're not the Greeks anymore, and we're not from Mesopotamia. We don't have those heroes, but Stan Lee gave us a whole new group of heroes that maybe 1,000 years from now or 3,000 years from now, people will be talking about the Hulk in the same way they talk about, Gilgamesh. So I want to say thank you for that. And rest in peace, Stan Lee. And finally, Excelsior. I want to thank you all for listening to Power to the People, episode 18. If you have not subscribed, I don't know what you're waiting on. I keep telling you every single week, please subscribe to Power to the People so you can get this stuff as soon as it comes out. Hot off the presses, because sometimes I'm hot when I'm doing it. So make sure you get this stuff right now, hot off the presses. Subscribe to Power to the People at the OG Podcast Network. You can also subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So make sure you do that. And you can also follow us at Powell to the Peeps on Twitter. P-O-W-E-L-L, the number 2, the letters D-A-P-E-E-P-S. Powell to the Peeps on Twitter. Or you can follow me at Comic Tony Powell on Twitter. And you can also follow our Facebook page, Powell to the People on Facebook. Thanks again. See you guys next week.